This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You are listening to Voice of Vashon, KVSH 101.9 FM. All VOV shows are also available on demand at voiceofvashon.org. During the next hour, I'll be talking with Patricia Henley and Elizabeth Stuckey French, co-authors of a new young adult novel titled Where Wicked Starts. Also, as is the tradition here at Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, I'll be reading a new piece from my Vashon After the Change flash fiction series at the end of the show, so stick around. And now, Patricia, welcome.
Thank you.
So you guys took the plunge. I would love if you could start off just with a little bit of that background story.
Sure. Well, Elizabeth and I have known each other for 27 years. She was my student at Purdue the first year I taught at Purdue University, 1987.
Wow.
And so we've known each other a long time. After she graduated, we became very good friends. We had kept in very close touch with each other. We've traveled together. We know each other's families.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very close friendship. And we wanted to hang out together. We wanted to spend more time together.
Mm-hmm.
We thought we had to find a way to work and be together. And that's how the story started. And I went back to our emails of a few years ago when we first started this project to see how long it took to get the basic idea going.
Mm-hmm.
And within about a month of starting to think about it, we had mapped out the four major characters,
mm-hmm.
written character sketches of them. I decided who was going to be Luna, who was going to be Nick.
Mm-hmm.
We had a general idea of the storyline.
So, well, now that makes so much sense. I did not already know that the two of you had known each other for so long. And because I've heard stories of writers that will joke about how proud they are that they didn't kill each other during the process of writing a novel together.
Uh-huh,
you know,
uh-huh.
It can be really challenging. But yeah, when you know each other that well, I imagine that would make it a lot easier.
Well, it was easy in the sense that we started it as a lark. And we agreed at the beginning, let's not be too attached to this. If I write something that you think really isn't working, just tell me.
Mm-hmm.
We both said that. And so we didn't have, our egos weren't involved.
Yeah.
And we did not have a single disagreement. Through the entire process,
well,
it was amazing.
Apparently, the next book you're going to write is about how to co-write without having a disagreement.
There you go.
I
hope the next book we write will be a sequel to Where Wicked Starts.
Right. I know these girls deserve to be in our lives again. So you mentioned briefly there's two girls, Luna and Nick, and there are a number of young adult novels out there right now that have taken the format you guys have, where one chapter is from the point of view of Nick and the next chapter is the point of view of Luna. And you, how did that affect how the two of you took responsibility for different elements of the story?
As I said, we had our general idea of the plot, but I wrote the first chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Sent it to her, and then she basically had to bounce off that
mm-hmm.
and send me the second chapter. I didn't know what she might include in the second chapter.
Wow.
And she didn't know what I might include in the third chapter. And so it was always a surprise, a wonderful surprises. And it was really a joy to not have to carry the entire burden of writing the novel by myself.
That sounds like so much fun, because when you get the chapter, you're the reader. You're the reader of your friend's chapter, and you get to read it with that joy you get from not, you know, the job of being the writer changes the tenor of the experience when you're reading something.
Definitely. So
wow.
It was, as I said, Elizabeth was full of surprises that mm-hmm. were wonderful for the book, and I would just take them and run with them, you know, in the next chapter.
It was almost like a game of telephone.
Yes, it was like a writing assignment.
Right, right. Oh, okay. Well, there you go. So people like any of my listeners who have friends that they write with and they've, you know, thought of collaborative right there, that is I don't even think I ever would have imagined the idea of literally, okay, you send me your chapter and then I'll just take it from there and go. I love that.
That's what we did.
Well, it works. And of course it works because both of them have such a distinct perspective that they didn't have to be pre-planned in advance to agree on anything, especially since they're stepsisters. They can knock it along quite fine.
That was an important part of it, that they were stepsisters who really thought they didn't like each other. And so we could easily, in each chapter, we could easily just be as abrasive as we wanted to be.
On the outside.
For the other sister. And so it worked well that was what that's what we'd set up with the two girls.
Okay, so.
But Mark, you might be interested in this.
Yes.
We started writing the book as a book for tweens.
Mm-hmm.
10 to 13-year-olds. And we wrote an entire draft that way. And the editor at Lacewing is the one who said, you all are not meant to write for tweens. You need to rewrite this and let yourself go and forget who you're writing it for. Just write it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was so right. And he's the one who really gave us permission to write the book that Where Wicked Starts ended up being, you know.
So what I'm hearing from that, and I think this will help it make a little bit more sense, is that there's popular fiction and there's literary fiction. And when I was reading this book, you did a really good job of maintaining, like, the subjects that were coming up. I could believe that these kids at this age could be thinking of those things, but it was right on the edge. I mean, these were precocious young girls but at the same time, they weren't unusual. That's what was sort of shocking, is to be reminded of just how adult-minded young people can be half of the time. The other half of the time, they're reverting back into childhood, right? But they also are on the cusp of understanding adulthood. And so I think what you're saying is, he said, basically don't teen it down or you know, try to make it kiddish. Just go for the guts.
Write the way you want to write it. Write the book you would like to read or you would have liked to have read when you were 16 years old.
Right. And it's very much, it doesn't feel dumbed down at all. A lot of times, I felt like I have kids, two boys that are 13 and 16, and I love their friends. I mean, my kids are great, and I'm really happy to know their friends as well. And I just really enjoy teenagers. Personally, I just really enjoy them. And I could imagine all these girls I know that are like 12, 13 on up, reading this and getting it.
Oh, good.
You know, they may not show it in their outward behavior because they're trying to be cute or popular or funny or whatever, but their brains are there and ready for this, I think.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that. I'm glad you viewed it that way. Nick, my character, I think, you know, you mentioned that sort of bouncing back and forth between being more adult and being childish.
Yeah.
I think my character really does that, I think, because her mother died six years before the story begins. And even though she's very bright and precocious in a way and insightful about people, she also has a kind of babyish side to her that she's trying to change because she's almost stunted in certain ways by her mother dying.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has that sort of seesawing back and forth between being a kid and wanting to grow up.
And she's a little bit younger. I mean, Luna's like, wow, the difference between my son being 15 and 16 is sort of like night and day. And I think Luna's around 15?
She's almost 16.
Right, yeah. So she would have less of the child coming up and more of the adult coming up. And Nick is so one of the reasons why I asked if I could interview you guys about this book is because it does such a great job of addressing real world social issues that need our attention. And so you have this great fictional story that will keep the reader riveted and they want to come back to find out what happened next. And at the same time, when they finish the book, I don't think they're going to walk away and be like, oh, that was nice. And it's gone. It sticks with you and it makes you more aware of the issues that are raised. So one of the ones obviously has to do with the big one, has to do with missing children. And I was wondering if you wanted to tell a little bit about how you guys decided to focus in on that.
Well, it seems like you can't go anywhere or read anything or watch anything without hearing about all these abducted children.
Mm-hmm.
And they do stick with you if you take the time to look at their pictures and their stories. So that seemed an obvious mystery for us.
Mm-hmm.
Because it happens all the time. It's not unusual.
And you initially wanted to start this as a bit of a mystery series.
Yes, we wanted to have there to be a mystery. We wanted the girls to be amateur sleuths like Nancy Drew was
mm-hmm.
many years ago. And Elizabeth heard a story about a woman who listened to her intuition and helped a girl who had been abducted.
Well, that's an amazing story. You want to tell a little bit more about it?
Well, she may speak at length about it when she talks to you. I don't know if you want me to get into it now.
I'll let Elizabeth do it.
That really spoke to us because the woman who helped that girl used her intuition. And I think so many times we deny that little voice that says, mm-hmm. there's something wrong here.
Well, and she did a lot more than even listening to her intuition. She went extremely out of her way on a limb and said, there's every possible reason, 99.9%, that nothing's going on here. But if I don't listen to that and that intuition was correct, then something really bad could happen. I'm going to take the time out of my life to go do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and it ended up being so important that she did that.
And obviously our girls are sort of bored
mm-hmm.
and it's Christmas break and they don't even know if their parents are going to celebrate Christmas in a big way this year because of opening a business.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not quite sure if they're making this up,
mm-hmm.
you know, about the girl being kidnapped. And so that's part of the suspense, I think, in the story is, are the girls spot on or are they... are their imaginations just running away with them?
Right.
And we won't say what happened.
No. Well, and so, sure. I mean, anytime our intuition quivers, we have to question ourselves, oh, well, you know, am I onto something or am I imagining something?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So there's literally an epidemic of children being kidnapped around the world mm-hmm. and in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's a major issue. And at the same time, it's completely normal for adults in our society to be fairly dismissive towards young people.
Sure.
You know, and these kids come up to the parents and they're like, you know, they do the right thing. They go and say, hey, we saw this. We're concerned, da-da-da. And they're completely blown off.
Yes, they don't want to be bothered, basically.
And that does, and it rings true, which is what's concerning, I think, is that... It wasn't a stretch for those parents to blow it off. It just, you know, you could see that happening in a lot of families around the country.
Sure. Luna watches Dateline and all those crime shows. And so her mother says, this is what happens.
Mm-hmm.
When you watch all those shows, your imagination runs wild.
Right. So we've got the girls. So for young people who read this book, I mean, you know, some of my listeners might be like, okay, I want to get something awesome, you know, for a friend who is having, you know, a birthday party or holidays are coming up or something. And this is a book, when I think about who I would give this book to, if I gave it to a young person, then I think they would get a sense of take myself seriously, honor myself. And there's all sorts of empowerment stuff we'll talk about in a minute. If I gave this to a girlfriend of mine who had children, I hope she would take away the idea of pay more attention and honor more what my children are saying. Be mindful.
I hope so too. Mm-hmm. I hope so too. I do want it to be empowering for girls, for them to feel more comfortable saying what they want, what they think, mm-hmm. and also for parents to see perhaps they need to pay more attention. And I think that's partly where the title comes from for me, where we could start, mm-hmm. where we could start the quote from Ernest Hemingway that opens the book is, all wickedness starts with innocence. Mm-hmm. And I think it is kind of an innocent attitude that the parents have. Oh, there's nothing wrong in our world. Everything's cool.
You guys do not avoid the white elephants in the room. So let's start with Nick. Nick is fabulous because she is dealing with reentry into a new social environment, and you mm-hmm. deal with, I think it's one, two, I'd say that she's got the three major issues going on, the loss of her mom. Then you tackle food, how she is using sweets and various types of food to manage her emotions. And we delve into the rarely talked about topic of girls and masturbation. So yes. What would you like to say? Because you wrote Nick. So what are your thoughts around that?
Well, I think Nick, I wanted Nick to be honest with herself, but very secretive. And I think girls masturbating is one of the big secrets. I mean, I think it's still a big secret. I know it certainly was when I was a girl. And and I would love to see girls be more honest about that, because I think we talked earlier about it, with boys, it's honest. There's a lot of joking around about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with girls, it's very secretive, and it shouldn't be. It should be known as a way to satisfy their natural hormonal urges mm-hmm. without letting a boy take advantage of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. It puts the power directly into their control.
Yes. And I just hope that girls that read the book walk away thinking, it's okay, and it's probably good for me.
Mm-hmm.
About the food, I think that's just such a common thing that we eat when we're not happy mm-hmm. or when we're anxious. And so many girls, and so many women, of course, but so many girls today are worried about body image and being fat, and Nick worries about that, but at the same time, her secret hoard of candy in the closet makes her happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has a real conflict about that.
But what's beautiful about it is that it didn't become the number one issue, and it didn't have to be resolved, and she didn't have to overcome it in order to be an okay person. I mean, this happens over a 3-week period of time, I think, roughly, this
yes.
entire story. So
yes.
at some point, for her health, it'll be something that we'll want her to deal with. But it's like, in a way, by letting this be something that she is dealing with and not fixing it, I think that was actually more empowering than if it had been fixed, because the fix implies that it's just so terrible that you grab a chocolate bar when you're feeling bad and
yeah.
you know, and it's in a way, you know what I'm saying? So I really like how you left that. You guys left a lot of things still floating. These characters are very alive at the end. They're not nicely closed down storyline. Everything's cinched together and finished and done. They're still in flow.
Well, thank you for saying that. I really appreciate you putting it that way. No, I didn't think that needed to be resolved. As a matter of fact, Nick goes in the house to make brownies at the end.
Right. I like brownies.
And then about Nick's mother dying, she is seeing a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And she is trying to come to terms with missing her mother, which, of course, has been brought to a head by the fact that she now has a stepmother.
Mm-hmm.
And does she call this stepmother mother? Does she let her tell her what to do?
Mm-hmm.
What role does her real mother play now? And in fact, it's sort of been given, Nick has sort of been given to understand that it's not right to talk about her mother too much now that there's a stepmother.
Right.
So, you know, it's Nick's issues about blended family and what does family mean now that I don't have a mother.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in the book, and I really enjoyed writing those passages because I think how we make families in our culture today, it's very complicated.
Oh.
Families are very complicated.
Yeah.
And kids are dealing with this every day, the issue of blended families.
Mm-hmm.
How do I relate to you, to this new person in our household?
And not only is it a blended family, like now you're in this position of parenthood over me and I'm 7 and I've just met you, you know, but not only that is the forgetfulness we have as a society that there are so many different cultures within, you know, the world within our area. I mean, it's sort of like when I lived in co-housing in West Seattle for, 6 years I was involved. I lived there for 4 and I helped to develop it in the first 2. And when you have a co-housing community, there's usually like a baseline platform or a reason for the creation of this idea. Some of them will be about ecological living or whatever they're going to be about. Sometimes they'll be about a religion or something. And the one that we got involved with was focused on diversity. And the whole idea was we want diversity. So there was different size houses. And then they found that most of the people who are interested in co-housing are usually fairly displaced white people, to be honest. Generally, people of color are oftentimes in their own micro communities. They actually really work together oftentimes with each other and they're still grounded. And so they ended up with a bunch of people who, on the outside, as far as their skin color was concerned, were all basically European derived. And there was then this assumption that that meant we all had the same basic culture. And man, we did not have the same culture. And I remember saying, it would have been easier to live here if every single person was a different color of the rainbow and from a different planet, because we would have assumed what you're saying may not mean what I think you're saying, and we would have taken time to check with each other. Instead, we just jumped to assumptions right, left, and otherwise, and it created no end of havoc. So this mom that's, you know, the new girlfriend and then wife that the father gets, it's not just that she's filling this different position, but she's from a different culture. You know, she
is from a different culture.
Totally different background expectations. So we are expecting children to deal with a major complexity in today's society on every level.
Sure. And many of them do just fine, but I'm hoping this book is going to be an encouragement to them. The girls who are, particularly to girls who are in blended families.
Right. And, well, there's that idea when you're sitting in class and you have a question and you think you're the only one with the question. But if you ask it, probably 9 other people or more in the classroom had the same question. This book, I think girls in particular that read this, and I do think it's a good book potentially for a boy to read.
Sure.
But girls, it's girls, so they're going to really relate. And I think a lot of them are going to go, oh, I'm not the only one thinking this. I'm not the only one dealing with this.
Exactly.
You know, these characters were written by other people who are real people, that I'm not alone.
I'm not alone. That's wonderful.
So I'm very happy you guys wrote this.
Thank you so much, Marge. I really appreciate it. We're just sort of getting it out into the world right now, and it's so wonderful to hear from readers, and it's just really gratifying to know that it speaks to people.
Yeah.
And I think you're right about boys. You know, I think boys could get some insight into how girls think by reading this, you know?
Yeah.
Like there's that great description of Luna talking about her sexual activity. And boys might learn something from that about how they come across, you know?
Right. Or how the girl feels later.
Yes, how the girl feels later. Yeah.
Yeah. And girls, once again, you know, it's hard when you live in a patriarchy. It's very difficult to see from inside of that society to even see it clearly. But, you know, some people would say, well, come on, you know, what teenage boy is going to want to read a story that's based upon a teenage girl's perspective? And I'm like, really? Okay, how many books out there are considered just books that are good for everyone and the main protagonist is a guy? I mean,
of course.
girls are expected to internalize and understand the anger, the hero, and all the complexes that boys get to go through. But then we sort of think, oh, well, boys wouldn't be interested in the other side. And it's like, okay, maybe they would.
Maybe they would. I hope they will be. I know some people have bought this book for teenage boys.
Just for the insight.
Yes.
So for people who are looking for this book so that they don't come banging on my door and asking for my copy, I think they can check with the librarians on the island or wherever they live, because we do have people who listen to this show in other parts of the world. So librarians, if they don't already have the book, usually they have the opportunity to get it in, don't they?
Oh, yes. Librarians can order this book.
Are you in the middle or near the tail end or still at the beginning of the whole process of getting this book out to the world?
Well, we did a little Midwestern tour, and I have one more event tomorrow. I may have a couple more events here in Cincinnati. And then we're doing four events in Florida in January. We're appearing at Florida State University, Flagler College, Rollins College, and Florida Southern.
And Florida is where the story is based.
Yes, and the story is set in Florida. And if your listeners are interested, if they live in Florida, they could, and they're interested in coming to one of our events, they could go to Elizabeth's website, ElizabethStuckeyFrench.com, and she has the events listed on her website.
A lot of times people have this impression that writers just go off into a little cabin in the woods and they write some beautiful manuscript and they ship it off and the publisher just takes it from there. But my impression is that in today's world, it's much more collaborative.
Well, I think it is with a small press.
Yeah.
If you have a good editor, I think it is. I've had the privilege of working with some very, very good editors over the years. When I was edited, when Hummingbird House was edited, my first novel, that was a very collaborative process. I've just been really, really fortunate to have very good collaborators along the way.
So you and Elizabeth had so much fun with this that we can expect there to be more continuations of Nick and Luna's adventures, I would imagine, in the future.
I hope so.
I'd like to just finish really quickly. I want to quote something from the back of the book. I think that'd be fun just to give people a sense of the energy around this. So it says, "That's when I noticed the couple we later named Boney and Mr. Creep, sitting two rows in front of us. He had his arm around her, not like a father would do, or like I imagined a father would do, slinging his arm over the back of her chair. No, his arm was around her shoulders like she was his date. Boney kept wriggling, but he would just grip her harder. Finally, she gave up and sat still. He leaned over and licked her cheek." So what's going on and what's going to happen?
I think that's a great passage to put on the back of the book. It's so creepy.
Bam. It's like, this is what we're dealing with. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, remind me. Oh, what's the name of the teen boy that Luna has a crush on again?
TJ.
Right. Right. I really want to see what happens with TJ in the next book.
Oh, good. So Elizabeth will be so glad to hear that.
Okay, because I'm like, you guys have started him. I know he's just hanging there waiting to become more prominent. And I'm like, bring it on, bring it on.
Okay.
Patricia, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate that.
Marge, it's been lovely talking with you. And it makes me so happy that you get the book, that you understand so many of the things we're trying to do. I really appreciate you helping us put it out in the world.
Yeah, I couldn't be more happy. Okie doke. So once again, this is March Twisdale, and you've been listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where authors get a chance to share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader at a time. A quick reminder to set your dial to Voice of Vashon, KVSH, 101.9 FM, and you can get your daily dose of all local programming. If you miss part of the show, you can always listen in on demand at voiceofvashon.org. As I mentioned earlier, Where Wicked Starts, a young adult mystery novel, is the brainchild of two lovely authors, and for the rest of the show, I'll be talking with Patricia's co-writer, Elizabeth Stuckey French. Elizabeth, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. So Where Wicked Starts is based in Florida.
Yes, it is.
And now, but Patricia doesn't live in Florida, so how did you guys choose Florida? Was there a specific reason?
Patricia, well, I live in Tallahassee, and I had been to visit St. Augustine quite a few times. It's really an unusual, cool old city, kind of touristy, but just sort of almost New Orleans-y. And Patricia and her friend Nance had offered writing workshops for women in St. Augustine for a few years. So I went there, and Patricia really loved the city. So we just thought we didn't want to do it in Tallahassee, so St. Augustine was the perfect place.
Well, and it certainly feeds into the storyline. It sounds like it's sort of a smallish town.
Yeah. In Tallahassee, you wouldn't really see a man and a young girl hanging out together that much because the whole city's so spread out. But some place like St. Augustine, all the tourists kind of go certain places. We did, I don't know if she mentioned this, but we did change the name of it because we just didn't want to have to, you know, mirror our city exactly on what St. Augustine is like. So we changed the name of it, plus we had the characters having just moved there, which also helped. It's different than if you've grown up somewhere, obviously. So
right. And so the kids are going to have, in a way, almost a more fresh view, which which lends itself to them being characters paying close attention to what's going on.
Exactly.
Well, I love when, thank you for sharing those thoughts, because a lot of times a person who has not written a book will pick a book up and you lay there, you know, in bed or sit in a couch for 6 hours while you enjoy this fabulous story. And how often do we then think to ourselves, I want to appreciate the author who spent the last 4.5 years of their life devoted to my 6-hour, you know, experience.
That's true.
So much goes into creating an excellent story, and I love Where Wicked Starts.
Well,
I think it's great.
I think, I'm sure Patricia must have said this too, but we just had so much fun writing it. We wanted to write a book that was really fun. And it ended up being a little darker than what we had intended and kind of got into areas that are a little murkier, but the whole project was just a blast. I mean, it was, you know, there were difficult things about it, but we really worked together well.
There's a couple authors out there that, like, when they've been interviewed about having co-written a novel together, they're very happy that they didn't murder each other during the process.
I don't know if it's because we've known each other for so long. I mean, I had her as a professor at Purdue, maybe 88 or something like that. And we knew that we could trust each other, I guess. And,
Not,
we weren't in it for the big ego thing.
Right. I actually co-write myself, and it's the same idea.
Oh, cool.
I have, not my novel, but I have a series that I write for a local paper about community conversations around health. And about 1,000-word articles once a month. So it's no huge thing. But, oh my gosh, we're dealing with pretty intense issues sometimes, vaccines or other issues that can be contentious. And people have no idea how many days and weeks and hours can go into trying to just word it in just the right way.
Right.
But she and I have known each other for 15 years. And there's that sense of trust, like everything you were just saying.
The good thing is, too, we talked over the initial, you know, what we wanted to happen. It was just sort of like wouldn't it be fun to write a book like this?
And,
so it just sort of started out as this fun game almost.
That was what Patricia said when I spoke with her earlier. Yes.
I think it would be really hard. Do you and your co-writer just, like, write together? Or I think it'd be hard to just have one person put the words down and the other one have all the ideas. I think that would be hard.
Yeah, no, she and I are both we are both very passionate sort of about informed consent and people having the right to make their own decisions about medical care. And even though her children have had almost all of the vaccines that are currently available and recommended, and my children have had only probably about 4 or 5 of the possible vaccines, and I waited like a decade, you know, a lot longer than she did. So even though we're on different areas, neither one of us feels like anybody else should do what we're doing. And so it's very much, I think, similar. It's something that you come at it from fun.
Right.
But what'll happen is I'll be like, well, what about this subject? And she'll say, that's fun. Write something about it. So I'll write something up and throw it at her and say, okay, well, what do you think? And then she'll come back. And so we toss it back and forth and back and forth. But the understanding is nothing will ever go to print until both of us are 100% willing to sign off on it because it has both of our names on it, right?
Sure, yeah.
And we've learned a lot through the process of co-writing.
It's fun because writing is generally such a solitary kind of job, and you get so attached to your little thing you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really nice to do it collaboratively, like, I guess, screenwriters and other people like that are used to doing.
Yeah, comedy shows, right? Don't they normally have a team of like 9 people
right,
who will
be
sitting in the room throwing out comedy?
Right.
Yeah. And I'm not a very funny person, so I really appreciate people.
I would appreciate that. Yeah.
I'm like, yay. Yeah. Well, and so like I talked about some of the characters with Patricia because this book is chock full of messaging and information and issues, really real world issues. I mean, supernatural stuff is a lot of fun. I have some of that in my novel, but I really love it when someone is talking about that white elephant in the room that just doesn't get talked about very much. You guys do that a bunch.
Me too. I love reading about that. I mean, I'm always telling my students you have to have your characters actually say things instead of just thinking them. Because that's what we do in real life. We just think them.
Right.
We don't say them, but it's just a lot more dramatic and satisfying if someone actually blurts something out.
Right. Right. And the more uncomfortable the characters are, the more thrilling the ride for the reader in a way.
Yeah, that's true. And it's sometimes hard to make your precious little characters uncomfortable. I mean, I think that's something you have to kind of ease your way into.
Mm-hmm.
You want to protect them. And we definitely had to do that with this book because we started out writing, I don't want to say less serious, but it was not nearly as dark as the version we ended up with. The girls were much squeakier clean and the parents didn't really fight. And then we had such a good editor who had told us we were holding back and we should just write this like we'd write any of our books.
That's what Patricia mentioned, was that you guys really got, like, your publisher basically said, nah, go for it.
Right.
Well, I'm looking at one of those moments, and so we've got Mr. Creep, the nickname that these girls have for a makes you very nervous character. And this is on page 58, where they actually have had the gumption to go right up to the door of this house where they think some seriously scary stuff is going on. We've got the wife and her strange behavior.
Right.
And Boney, the nickname the kids have given for this little girl who they haven't been able to talk to yet. There's all sorts of stuff happening right here in half a page.
Yeah, that's true. It's something that I can kind of imagine myself having done when I was that age. You know the book Harriet the Spy? I'm sure you've heard of that. This friend of mine and I had a spy route. We wanted ours to be like hers. We went through people's trash and dug out letters they'd written and took them home and poured over them and looked
through
people's windows. And that was back when people wrote letters.
Right.
But we never had the guts to actually, you know, go in someone's house, thank God. But I could see, you know, the sort of state these girls are in, that it just might be something stupid they do, especially because of TJ sort of egging them on.
And if I understand correctly, this is most likely the beginning of a couple of books, maybe a short series, and we're going to learn more about TJ in the next book, I understand.
Right. Yeah, he's one of those characters that sort of took over, kind of like Luna's father.
Right. He's a treat.
At first, he was just a very peripheral character, and then we thought, well, let's just have him show up.
Yeah.
After that, he was so much fun to write because he was very unpredictable and irresponsible, but he was also really willing to listen to them and treat them more like adults in some way that they were both craving.
Well, you know, and isn't that in society right now, you know, I see some of this, of course, in my own community and stuff, is that the more in the box a person is seeking to be, they want to succeed in the box. So, for example, the parents, and what I mean by that, of course, is dad and Kat, and then you've got Kat's ex-husband, who's the one you were talking about, who shows up later. And they are seeking to succeed in business. they want to work in the tourist field. They've already told the kids they can't have a dog because, you know, some people are allergic to pets. You know, there's all these ways in which they're sort of constricting their own life. They're painting their house and designing their home environment to meet the needs of other people in order you know, it's very in the box moment in their life. And then these girls run into something that is potentially out of the box. And you're right, the in the box moment adults can't go there. But then the out of the box ex-husband, you know, dad who's here and there and completely unreliable, well, he's living in that out of the box world. So when the girls talk to him, it's like he can go there.
Right. That's a really good way of describing it. I hadn't really thought of that. And I think some of that I can identify with the parents as well as Taylor, because, you know, when your kids are little, and I've never tried to rehab a B&B with my husband, but, you know, just trying to get everything done and take care of everything, you just, a lot of times you can't really hear anything that's, or notice anything, or pay attention to things that you should be paying attention to. That's like one of my worst nightmares.
What are some of the things that you were hoping to gift to your readers as they went through this story and walked in the shoes of these two characters?
I guess, you know, I don't know how profound it is, but I guess just not to give up. My character Luna, the way I conceived of her, and I, as part of like an exercise for myself, I wrote up her entire life and her backstory with her mom, kind of going from man to man to man, one inappropriate guy after another. And she's just really burnt out and doesn't trust people and really has no confidence in this marriage with Jimmy. And she doesn't want this girl as a stepsister. But I think that what I really came to see as I was writing it is that,
No, that's fine. You got a puppy dog. That's cool.
That, you know, I wanted some of her cynicism and her world weariness to sort of crack open. That's one of the things that I would have said to myself as a girl that age. I mean, I didn't have a mom who did that kind of thing. But I felt really unheard by my parents a lot of the time, and unnoticed and frustrated. I mean, she just, she saw what she wanted to see in other
ways.
And I just got so frustrated. But, you know, there's hope beyond that, I guess. You can't expect too much out of any one person, and you can find help in unlikely places.
Right.
Like Nana Fanny, I just thought she was hilarious. You know, there are people who will listen to you and help you, and I've found that true all my life. That's something that I really wanted to explore, and I wanted Luna to open up to that.
I think, you know, I think you totally nailed your goal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like you go on and on for paragraph after paragraph of her bemoaning her situation.
Yeah.
At the same time, like you said, you didn't make her just some girl who has these nice, comfortable, polite concerns. I mean, there's the sexual situations that she gets into with a couple of kids, which are mostly alluded to, but they're absolutely intense, and they do happen at that age.
Right.
And you just dove right into
that. Thinking, why am I doing this? I don't even want to do this. There was kind of a moment like that in the scene where she's sitting in the cafeteria with those popular girls, and one of them brings wine.
Yeah.
And pours everybody a glass. In my original version of the book, my character Luna said, "No, thank you. I'm not, you know, I don't drink wine. I'm not going to drink it because of my father." And it wasn't until a much further revision that I just thought, well, a kid would just say, "I'm not going to do that," and then they do it. You know, that's like every parent's nightmare.
Well, and I've watched kids over the last few years who have family history with addiction, and they go through this really beautiful, bright stage where there's like this clarity, and it's like pre-teen hormones, right? It's like the end of childhood, before the teen hormones, that last 6 months when you're like, okay, I'm going to talk to him about condoms now or I'll never get to do it, right?
You know?
Even though they're only 11, but you know, and the, you know, there'd be comments of, you know, well, I'm not going to do that because of my mom or because of my dad or my grandpa or whatever. And then a year and a half later, where you just do it and you don't even know why necessarily later.
Yeah. So I guess that's one example of how we kind of dramatize things a little bit and push them in the second draft. But I did want Luna to be borderline kind of a bad kid, but not all the way. still vacillating.
Well, now, so this makes me wonder what's going to happen with, it's TJ, right? Not Jake,
right.
TJ. You know, little teeny tiny cliffhangers, like the house is, well, something happens to the house, and all of a sudden, for some reason, you know, this love interest is out there on his car, and it's like, why is he here?
Right.
And I'm like, either that's just a coincidence or that's a major cliffhanger.
Right. I think it's the latter.
But,
you know, that's something Patricia put in there. And I was like, that's cool. I would never even occurred to me to have TJ just show up there.
And you left it that way. You didn't answer the question. You left it hanging.
Right. Why was he driving by there?
Yeah.
And he sat there and held her hand or something. So.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I know. So, and I was like, ooh. if you are looking for a book that combines a lot of fun, mystery, and, you know, keeps you riveted. I mean, this was one of my really easy books to read. I just sort of boom, 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 kept going with it. And at the same time, it's got rich, rich messaging and, in a way, mentoring of young people. It's that, guess what? These characters would understand if you told them what you were going through, they would get you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
very true.
And that's what young people need, but young girls in particular, I think, are so often not heard.
I think so too. And the whole thing with the kidnapping plot, that's kind of what got us into it. But I see that as sort of like something that a magician doing tricks. Magic tricks will try to get you to watch that carried through the story by that plot, but what the real story is sort of going on underneath that, and you kind of feel it, but you don't really notice it as you're reading, and hopefully by the end it sort of has an impact on you. But, you know, the stuff about trusting people and learning to trust your intuition, and not giving up even though things seem kind of dire.
Yeah, no, I think you completely nailed that goal.
I mean, really.
It's the mystery piece is it's true. As you say, the mystery it almost feels like a separate story from the personal experiences of the girls, but they mesh so perfectly that when I came away from the story, if someone were to ask me what it was about, both of those would be what would come to mind.
Right.
Oh, it's about this, and it's about this mystery, and it's about this, and it's about this mystery. So you really, yeah, well done.
Oh, good. Thanks. That's good to hear.
Yeah, and thank you for writing it. How long did you guys work together on this?
I think we talked about it for probably about 6 months or so before we started. And we just emailed about it and talked on the phone and met up a couple times. But suddenly, one day in earnest, we just said, let's just go for it. So I think it took a couple years once we started writing it.
Thank you for sharing that, because a lot of, like I said earlier, a lot of readers really don't have a sense of how much time goes into creating. And this is only a 202 page book.
It's much shorter than anything else I've written. But yeah, it's a lot of things get discarded, and just trying to get across exactly what you want to get across. First figuring out what that is.
Yep.
And then like the balance you were talking about with Luna, you didn't want her to be just a snarky, unsympathetic character, nor did I want her to be a goody-goody. So trying to find that balance is...
Well, they're both very deep characters. The parents have to be a little bit more shallow because they're not the central characters of the story so much. But even they, because they're so tied in with what the girls are going through, they get enriched and deepened by the girls' experience because it relates to the family dynamic. So, yeah, really, I'm looking forward to the next book. Have you guys already started?
No, we're talking about. Well,
right.
I think we're going to have it be set somewhere else. Not sure where.
Maybe on a family vacation somewhere.
Yeah. Because
this only happened over a week, right? The whole storyline.
Right. So it'll be fun.
Oh.
Except if we go somewhere else, TJ won't go with them. So that's a consideration.
Well, you never know.
That's true.
I mean, you never know, right?
That's right.
I could come up with some ideas about why TJ would come along.
I probably could, too. I hate to give up on him.
Yeah, no, don't. Don't give up on him. So once again, this is Marge Twisdale for all of my listeners out there. And you're listening to my interview with guest author Elizabeth Stuckey French, who has co-written Where Wicked Starts with Patricia Henley, who I spoke with earlier. And now, as is the new tradition here at Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, I will be reading a new piece from my Vashon After the Change flash fiction series. So stick around for that. And now, Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Right on.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's that time of the show when I, March Twisdale, will share one of my flash fiction vignettes from my Vashon After the Change collection. Flash fiction generally falls under 1,000 words, with 500 to 700 being most preferred. And the goal is to give you, the reader, a flash-in-the-pan moment. We don't worry so much about what came before or will come after. It is more the quintessential moment that we are trying to capture. In fact, many flash fiction authors focus on standalone pieces. But I am using this genre to tell a larger, ongoing story. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Vashon After the Change storyline, I suggest you go to www.voiceofvashon.org and click on Prose, Poetry, and Purpose under the On Demand tab. Then you can listen to the last 10 minutes or so of my November and December shows, where I highlighted the first two pieces in my collection. But for now, I will tell you this. One night, when the island was sleeping, a mist settled around the waters that surround our small Pacific Northwest island, and upon waking, the residents discovered that their connection to the outside world was completely and impassably cut off. This flash fiction series is all about what happened next. And so, Vashon After the Change, journal entry number 381. I wish I had a gun. Sunlight lances through the salal, illuminating the berry stains on my brother's face. His head feels like a boulder on my calf and my foot is going numb, but I don't say anything. I just chew slowly on a young pine needle and listen. Do you think they're gone? His whisper is a shout in the dusky silence. This time, I give him a look, but it's been over 2 hours and he's reached his limit. If we had a gun, he goes on, we'd be home by now. We'd be dead, I counter, hoping he'll shut up. Be grateful we're dry. He glares back at me, years of younger brother resentment welling up. I squash it ruthlessly. And that they didn't have dogs. And then I hate myself as my brother's coffee brown face blanches milk white. He has a way of looking scared like a baby looks scared, making your stomach curdle as you desperately wish you could make everything safe and good, which is the worst wish one could have, making it so I don't hate myself anymore. Now I hate him. Our parents knew enough to worry about coons once the island ran dry of cheap cat food and trash cans went empty. But none of us thought about the dogs. Pets, smart enough to escape their starving owners, quickly formed vicious packs, and their allegiance, once lost, was sorely missed. I feel a tap on my ankle and ignore it. Like chickens scattering at the first sign of a hawk, our flight from the Center Forest Trail had been immediate and undiscussed. Mama Bird would have been proud as we dove into the brush, burrowed out of view, and froze. Still and silent, as rough voices meandered toward us, lingered until our bodies quaked with terror, then ever so slowly faded away. Tap, tap. I glance down. The sun has moved, and my brother's face is now hidden by evening shadow. I see him point. He wants to try for home. Now, before the dogs come. I nod, and we begin to crawl, filling the waiting forest with a symphony of trackable sounds. Eyes shut, hair full of leaf litter, my lip bleeds as flames race up my leg in vengeful, twitchy spasms, my heart ruthlessly pumping blood into the starved tissues. In voiceless agony, I squirm and twist after my brother. His eyes gleam up at me, wide and glassy, reflecting trace light that filters through thick, interlacing evergreen branches. Home? He asks. Or docks? We smell the stink of my fear at the same moment. He rushes on, seeking to catch me while I'm still persuadable. I know what he's doing, and that he's crazy, but I listen anyway. His voice is like the wind blowing through reeds. Who else is stupid enough to be in the forest at night? My silence is long enough that my brother jerks on the line, sinking the barb in deeper. We're as safe heading to docks as trying to get home. I mean, more than halfway there, right? We can spend the night looking for his gun stash, then go home once the sun's up. As if on cue, an owl hoots from the thick forest behind my brother, then again behind my goosebump-covered backside. As if to say, silent flight and darkness have kept me and my kin alive for eons. Why not you? Mom and Dad will kill us, I whisper, imagining all that will suffer when we fail to return. Still, I know he's right. No one else knows about the guns. Doc promised Mom that when he lay dying, when he looked like he was going to kiss her, but instead left blood on her ear and not her lips. I suck in my breath, ready to argue for caution. It's kept us alive this long, hasn't it? Then we hear a long, soulful howl rise up out of the darkness, followed by a familiar yip-yip, the reassuring call of our resident coyote pack, signaling that Center Forest hasn't fallen into dog territory yet. Our eyes meet. Fine, I say, as we turn away from home and head westward, side by side. Let's do this. This is an original work copyrighted by March Twisdale. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or transcriptions of this piece is expressly forbidden without the written permission of the author. And that's our show, folks. Once again, you are listening to Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSH. This is March Twisdale, program host and producer of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, the show where authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader at a time. And now I'll close with our island's own Cami Lundin and her title song, Run Free. One more example of inspiration through art.
Like the wild horse runs in the mountains, like the sun sets beyond the sea, like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. Run free and be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the beauty that hides inside, that hides inside. Like the moon floats in the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a